You're listening to Radio Area.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you woke up, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Thursday, August 8th, 2019. I'm Andy Donner, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon. And a thousand blades were flashing at the rising.
Comrades, for this week I have the next installment of the New Contact Learning series and review material I'm putting together from Early RFN. Now, as a reminder, I started this as a show for Harold's death, but I liked how that turned out so much that I'm going to make sure all of these are done with the material up through the first several RFN episodes. Today's show is a bit strange. The previous one covered episodes 2 through 9, and this one covers episodes 10 through 12. Initially, I was dismayed at how badly I had picked material, and I'd hoped to put more in a single episode. After having cut this material down, though, I think you'll agree this actually flows very well, and these three shows ought to be listened to in this way for new contacts. The events of this last week provide another springboard for us to discuss what you ought not do, and there's plenty of that in this episode. In order to help listeners, especially new listeners, understand, the militia situation Harold is discussing in the material I'm about to play relates to the Hutare militia arrests in Michigan and other states from early 2010. You'll note that those references are all but gone simply because I wanted to make this material a little bit more generic and a little bit more applicable to many other situations, and I'm actually very happy with how it came out. I anticipate a certain amount of criticism that this isn't really a new show and it's just another form of rerun. Well, that's actually not true, and I'd like to change your mind about that. You'll recall last time I did one of these, I indicated everything we do from here on out needs to serve more than one purpose simply for the sake of efficiency, or else we aren't going to be able to hit our party professionalization goals. This material actually serves multiple purposes, and in that sense, this is the most efficient thing I can do at this time. First and foremost, I need to make absolutely certain I'm not simply throwing reading material and a few links at new contacts unless those links are actually very helpful, and this is the best way to go about that. Additionally, and I say this in all candor, not to rag on anyone, just pointing something out, a lot of this material was not internalized by the people who heard it the first time around, or else our situation would be very different right now, and I would like to politely ask everyone listening to actually make some effort to grok this and apply it in their own lives, as they should have done years ago. And lastly, and most interesting, at least to me personally, is that I've known much of this material for so long that it's actually really important for me to listen to it with a different ear and try to understand the perspective of someone that's never heard it before so that I can figure out what's most important and what's most helpful to them right away. If nothing else, sharing that work product with everyone involved is actually a good idea. And with that said, here's installment number 2 of our new listener introduction material. Enjoy.
Okay, the first email this week comes from Tom in California. Hi, Harold. Just between us, I like the radio broadcasts. If this is not too late, I have a couple of subjects that you might want to address. Why not drop down into Northern California? It is a very conservative, white area and mountainous. With the gold reserves, water, timber, agriculture, so forth, it would be a very valuable part of the Northwest Republic. Which way will Utah go when America starts to break up and we make our intentions known? I know that they would prefer to be in their own sovereign country, but they might see us as a very viable option. This may be a topic to stir some good conversation and get more people to look outside the box. It is, of course, no coincidence that Comrade Tom happens to live in Northern California. We get this a lot, and we've been getting it ever since the publication of the first Northwest novels. People from Northern California, Alaska, Utah, Colorado, North and South Dakota often come to me suggesting that we include their home states in the projected boundaries of the Northwest American Republic, basically so they don't have to move. I've even had people try to persuade me to include San Francisco as part of the Northwest homeland so people living there don't have to move. Now, don't get me wrong, I get why these people want me to do this. Packing everything you own and moving stakes is an incredible hassle. Believe me, I get it. I do. God knows I should. I've done it myself often enough. I have nothing at all against these people who are trying to schmooze me into relieving them of the moral responsibility to pack that moving van. And I don't blame them for trying, not at all. But remember the whole theory behind what we're trying to do here, which is to concentrate our numbers in a given area to where we can actually form communities, real people living in the real world within half an hour's drive of each other, and begin functioning in the real world as opposed to the internet, and also to reduce the whole problem of white racial survival and revolution to manageable proportions. Remember, when the excrement impacts on the revolving blades, we want to be fighting a colonial war, struggling for the independence of a far-flung outpost of empire removed from the capital and the centers of wealth and power, a backwater that the wealthy Jews and multinational corporate executives of Washington and New York and Houston really won't be all that upset about giving up if it has to be done to preserve their power and their profits. We need land to grow into as a nation, true, but on the other hand, we have to keep this practical and we mustn't get too greedy. There are enough racially conscious whites so that if, I say if, we can ever get our act together, lay aside all our petty differences, stop listening to the goat-dancing idiots from the 1990s who hang around V-bulletin boards and still claim to lead us, and finally unite behind the Northwest migration, as every ounce of remaining common sense dictates that we should. If we can ever do those things, then we could easily concentrate 10 or 20,000 of us at least in 3.5 states. That will give us the basis for serious missionary work among the locals, so we can finally begin to draw our personnel not from the movement, but directly from the white community. That is a major strategic goal. We could be doing that now, of course, except that nobody in the white population of the Northwest knows that we are here. Our websites are stuck on a few hundred hits per day, and we haven't yet figured out how to get any responsible establishment publicity without somebody getting killed and without standing on a street corner holding a sign and wearing a costume and making fools out of ourselves. If that ever changes, we'll be on our way. But we do still have to reduce the problem to manageable proportions. The original proposed white homeland consisted of a core territory of 3 complete Northwest American states, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. We have since added Western Montana, largely because of the intensity and dedication of one single female comrade who is forming her own primary settlement area in Kalispell. But at some point, guys, we've got to draw the line. At various times in the past, other parts of the Northwest have been suggested as potentially forming part of the homeland. These include the northern third of California, above Redding, the state of Wyoming, the state of Alaska, and the present Canadian provinces of British Columbia and Alberta. Of those Canadian provinces, I would especially like to include in the Northwest Republic when the time comes, but they'll be the responsibility of Northwest Front Canada. There is a half-assed independence movement in Alaska, but it's kosher conservative and capitalist in nature, and so it's useless as a vehicle for racial survival. There is also a separatist movement with a distinct racial tinge to it that already exists in Western Canada, but they don't seem to have gotten very far with it. Neither have the French in Quebec, as far as that goes. The fact is that no separatist movement that attempts to use liberal democracy will ever get very far. Remember, the purpose of democracy is to prevent change. Now, for the entire 3.5 state settlement area, we are looking at a total of almost 300,000 square miles. That's a lot of territory to cover, as I can tell you just from the one road trip we did to Idaho a few weeks ago. We talk about reducing the scale of the problem, but let me tell you, the Northwest homeland is a big-ass place, and it's going to be hard for us to move around in it, given our limited resources, when even a single tank of gas is a major financial project. Imagine how it would be if we started to include these other areas and had to take road trips to Salt Lake City and Cheyenne or San Francisco just because some of our people don't want to exert the necessary effort of will to pack the moving van. The whole purpose of reducing our operational area to something manageable would be defeated. Just as we need communities of racially conscious white people living within half an hour's drive of one another, we need every place in the homeland to be within a long day's drive max. Now, when the balloon finally goes up, I personally would like to glom onto as much territory as possible. If we're in some kind of situation whereby we can acquire Northern California and Utah and Wyoming or whatever, great. But we don't know exactly how and when and under what circumstances the inevitable breakup of the United States is going to occur. Until we have a little more information in that area, the Northwest Front has to keep to the present 3.5 states. God knows they're going to be hard enough to work with on their own. I could spend all my time doing what all the other groups and spokesholes and personalities do, rabbiting on and on and on about the problem and uttering not one whisper about the solution or about the terrible flaws in our own character which prevent us from taking that solution. But at some point, somebody has to talk about these things out loud. We at the Northwest Front and we in the Northwest Migration Movement have to be different, if for no other reason than we're so small and so destitute that we can't possibly compete with some of these larger groups and websites when it comes to news commentary. If I'm going to somehow obtain enough of a market share, pardon the expression, in order to place the Northwest Front and the Northwest Migration at the head, first of the movement and then of the white community as a whole, then I have to start out by being different. I am going to have to talk primarily about the two topics which up until now we have avoided like the plague: solutions and character. I'm not trying to avoid the question about homeschooling, Chris. Obviously, homeschooling is something that is very necessary for young white children in order to keep them from becoming completely corrupted by this rotten world in which we're forced to live and raise them. But I am saying that you can probably get all kinds of fascinating and pertinent commentary on this subject off the other racial and conservative sites and V-Bulletin boards, and it would say all that could be said much better than I could and at much greater length. That doesn't mean I won't occasionally go off on long anti-Obongo or anti-Jew raves, believe me. I will find the time on more than one occasion to work some of those in, if for no other reason than they're just plain fun. We have to convey somehow to millions of white people the concept of the Pacific Northwest as a refuge and a homeland, a place where one can go to, quite frankly, flee from all the rubbish they're facing back in New York and Georgia and Texas and California. A lot of times people who advocate Northwest migration get this response from people: I ain't moving nowhere, Harold. I'm staying right here in Hogwaller, Arkansas, where my daddy and his daddy and his daddy before him was born and raised. We gotta stand and fight. Okay, great. More power to you. I'm all for that. But let's actually see some of this standing and fighting. Oh, and by the way, sitting behind a computer keyboard with a can of beer and posting silly gibberish to VNN doesn't count as standing and fighting. Ah, there's the rub. Nobody is standing and fighting. They're hunkering down and hiding in their homes, or else maybe running off into the piney woods and hiding in a double-wide mobile home with a closet full of guns, which I very much doubt will ever fire a single shot at the racial enemy. This talk about standing and fighting for all of America is basically just another excuse to avoid packing the moving van. Another excuse to do nothing. Hot damn, us white boys are good at that. Finding some logical, rational, and convincing reason to do nothing. Just like leaderless resistance. Great idea in theory, except in practice it's turned out to be all leaderless and no resistance. And that's not Louis Beam's fault. That's all on us. Lone wolf is the same way. It's all lone and no wolf. Just another excuse to avoid meeting other white nationalists in a Starbucks and to avoid packing that moving van for the Northwest. Contrary to popular belief, there is nothing at all dishonorable about fleeing from overwhelming force and tyranny. That has been done time and again by our people down through history, the Welsh and the Afrikaners, and, of course, many of the early settlers who fled from oppression of various kinds in Europe and came to this country from across the sea. The Pilgrims themselves were fleeing from oppression in England, you may recall. Remember the Swamp Fox during the Revolutionary War in South Carolina, who fought and ran away so he could fight another day, going over the top to charge the machine guns head-on like both sides did at Verdun and the Battle of the Somme during World War I is just stupid. Relocating out of bad situations is as Aryan as apple pie, so to speak. There is no honor or common sense in continuing to live in a place where you're surrounded by muds and most likely in physical danger. danger of being victimized because of the color of your skin. Why do so many of you keep on doing it? It's just plain dumb. Yeah, packing a moving van involves physical effort, but Jesus, are you all really that lazy? We have to let white people know that there is a home and a refuge for them here. And then the party has to make that so by giving new migrants everything we can in the way of assistance and support, which is one reason why I need to get everybody paying dues. You can't run a relocation agency, among other things, without funds. We are also going to be required to pump up a major propaganda effort on our part, something we can't really do on just a few hundred hits a day on our websites. This major effort will have to come when somehow or other we break out of the bubble. When we can make white people aware of the fact that we are here, and when tens of thousands of people begin to actually read and hear and eventually to see on video what we have to say. So it's not for lack of our trying on the internet. Where we're falling down is getting those URLs in front of the people who need to see them and persuading them to go there. When we reach the point where we have a much wider audience than we do now, an audience comprised mostly of new people who have never had any exposure before to white racial views of any kind other than what they see on television and in the movies, then we'll have to change a lot of the orientation and direction of much of our propaganda. There will have to be sections of our websites and our printed literature that deal with basic racial and ideological issues, above all, teaching our people about the all-important Jewish question. And yes, one of the incentives we will have to hold out to our people is the promise of a genuinely new and fresh start, free from debt and free from all of the 10 tons of crap that politically correct democracy loads onto white people's backs. Somehow or other, we're going to have to strike a chord in our people that hasn't been struck for a long time. We're going to have to persuade them to do what hundreds of thousands of our ancestors did 150 years ago. Pack all their stuff into a Conestoga wagon, or in this case a U-Haul truck, and strike out on the Oregon Trail into the unknown. Okay, some people are methodical and motivated and personally organized in their lives, so for them it doesn't have to be this way. Now those people will be really glad to help in any way we can. Anybody can have a job and a house waiting for them once they get here if they devote a little effort to it. And this is an important proviso, if they haven't totally screwed the pooch where they are and they've managed to acquire skills and assets to bring with them to the homeland. But let's face it, how many white people these days are like that? This politically correct society maims, mangles, and destroys the lives of white people, especially white males. A lot of the people we have showing up here will be just as the comrade who mailed me described them, people who are, in fact, more or less fleeing from the horror of diversity and depression combined, fleeing from the collection agencies and the ex-wife's attorney, fleeing from the corrupt civil courts, fleeing from the violence and the squalor of the tenements where they are forced to live in racially mixed neighborhoods, fleeing from 100 different situations in their lives which have become absolutely intolerable. Some of these people will be those whom I think may be best described as the T-shirt youth, the young men with nothing but the T-shirts on their backs. We get a lot of those, especially when there's a bunkhouse and a refrigerator full of beer going. Some of the new migrants will be out-and-out economic refugees, fleeing from bill collectors and lawsuits and bankruptcies and court-ordered alimony and civil judgment payments. And we will need to provide such migrants with help to make sure that they're not further harassed and annoyed once they reach the homeland, so that they can truly start over. Some will be ideological and racially motivated, of course, and those will be the cream of the crop. But whatever their motivation, we have to find some way to get all of these people to actually pack that moving van and come here so that we can relearn the art of living in communities and get on with the job at hand of securing the existence of our people and a future for white children. The next email is a long one, and it comes from Larry in Las Vegas. Now, Larry sent in a whole raft of questions. Greetings, Mr. Covington. My name is Larry. I have been listening to your podcasts, and I've read your varied internet posts, and I agree with nearly all you say with regard to the devolution of white people, or, as I like to say, European Americans. Why can't we hyphenate as well? That's a minor question. I have a series of questions regarding what you propose. The last time there was a serious migration in this country, it was done by the Mormons in the middle of the 19th century, and they did it under much the same circumstances as we would be facing. They faced the elements and persecution. We, however, have modern conveniences and established infrastructure and homes to go to. They did not. With this said, my questions are as follows. Question number one, do you propose to begin the migration now? Well, yes, Larry, we've already begun the migration, nowhere near what it should be in terms of numbers, but you have to bear in mind that most Northwest migrants are of what we refer to as the organic variety. In other words, just normal people who have decided to up stakes and get the hell out of California or Florida or wherever they're living, surrounded by mud people, and come here. They use all the usual conservative code words, of course, like good schools and clean air and a sense of community. In other words, they're referring to all of the things that diversity and multiculturalism destroys. They would cut off their own ghoulies rather than admit that they are coming to the Northwest for any overtly racial reason. But bring up the subject of Mexicans and see how they react. Sometimes I think we have about half the white population of California living up here. Question number two, how will you govern, and who will govern this new nation? I have done some exploring around the so-called movement. What a bunch of dunces. I have found only one group that has people, and they have only a few who know what and how to run a government and structure. Well, Larry, what I'd like you to do is to go to our website at www.northwestfront.org, and along with all the other things on there, I would like you to check out the draft copy of the Constitution of the Northwest Republic. This is a genuine, honest-to-God constitution put together by an actual committee of serious adults. You may not like some of the provisions, but like it or not, it is a bona fide and workable attempt to provide an alternative form of government which would be suitable to a white nation-state. Read that draft, and you will find the answer to many of your questions there. Question number three, where will you get the experienced white people to run a government that will be able to do what you envision when many white nationalists today are felons, can't keep a job, are experts only at video games, can't balance a checkbook, and are the biggest cowards to boot? Has the cancer already advanced to the point where it may be every man for himself? Many of us who consider ourselves true national socialists, who have worked, have means, and would like to invest in a real nationalist opportunity, are left with nothing. Thus, we support comrades in Europe who do much more with far less, given the legal restrictions they face. They get elected to office without a First Amendment. Our nationalists are felons and urinate in public. Our nationalists have no understanding of culture, most likely have never heard a Wagner opera, but consider profanity-laden screaming as cultural music. Actually, Larry, that's one of the reasons I include the musical sections on these podcasts. I will admit that most Americans are rather limited in their musical education, and I hope to improve that. Now, Larry, I mentioned briefly this phenomenon in last week's podcast, and I've spoken about it before. This is what I refer to as our character issue, and I have spent the past 30 years going on and on and on about it. And for my trouble, I've been subjected to 30 years of abuse, insult, slander, and vilification. If you want to email me privately, I'll be happy to send you some copies of my old articles and blogs on the subject, but as to here and now, let me say this. Larry, I wish I could tell you that you were wrong. Unfortunately, you're not wrong, but neither are you completely correct. There are decent white nationalists, national socialists, and racial libertarians around. Many more of them than there were a few years ago. I know because they're beginning to gravitate to the Northwest Migration and the Northwest Front. We are getting a lot of people who spent years supporting other groups like the National Alliance when Dr. Pierce was still alive, and they're coming around to the NF now, and they like what they see. True, like everything else in our movement, it's still entirely too much internet and way too few boots on the ground. But frankly, I think I can say right now that we have more real, physical people actually doing things than almost anybody else you would care to name. Like everything else in our movement, it is a slow, slow, deadly slow process, slow as molasses in wintertime. Getting white people to do anything, even meet someone in a restaurant or get behind the wheel of a car and do some long-distance driving, is like pulling teeth. But I can tell you without hesitation that there is in fact a notable improvement in the character and the quality and the moral fiber of the people who are coming to our cause. At least here in the Northwest there is. As to where we will find the experienced white people to run a government, you seem to think that I have some idea that the government of the Northwest is going to be taken over by a bunch of drunken skinheads who lay around the state capitol drinking beer like it was a clubhouse or something. But that's not how it's going to happen. Any group of men and women who are capable of planning and executing a successful revolution will, almost by definition, also possess at least some of the necessary skills to run a government and a modern technological state. I also believe that by the time revolution becomes a reality, there will be white people who, while not white revolutionaries themselves, will be willing to step forward and help build a new nation. Because it will have become obvious that the old order is doomed, and quite simply, they will want to be on the winning side. Question number 4. I consider myself a national socialist. I have seen firsthand the failures of capitalism and the failures of the American plutocratic system. Marxism is also contrary to human nature. Do you propose a national socialist government? If so, I see this as difficult, given 99% of so-called American Nazis have no clue of what real national socialism is as to economic and other issues. All they want to do is yell and scream nigger and kike, and most have no concept as to character and turn on each other faster than a Jew can count pennies. It seems to me you are attempting to build a new nation for people that don't exist any longer, and at best are attempting to herd cats. Well, Larry, again, I refer you and others who have questions of this nature to the Northwest Constitution, which you will find on the web at www.northwestfront.org. I also sent you a copy of the White Book, which contains the Northwest Republic's Constitution, as an appendix. You need to sit down and study it. You will find some National Socialist aspects in the Constitution, yes, just as you'll find National Socialist programs referred to in my novels, specifically The Hill of the Ravens, which is set in the future Northwest American Republic after the War of Independence. Some of the Constitution also clearly derives from the United States Constitution, and specifically corrects some of the errors and problems which have appeared with that document in practice over the past 223 years. The Northwest Constitution clearly propounds a society based on free enterprise, but also on social duty. The trick here is to keep free enterprise, but effectively keep out capitalism. Remember, capitalism is just as racially poisonous to the white man as Marxism is. It is the capitalists who brought the Mexicans and other illegals here and who will be helping Barack Obama and his Jewish controllers keep them here throughout the upcoming amnesty in order to provide cheap labor and drive white wages and employment down. Question number 5. Do you plan on an internal society much like North Korea, or do you plan on openly seeking to enter the world stage and engage in world commerce? It should be noted that National Socialist Germany was a major exporter in world trade. Yes, it was. Well, Larry, realistically, we in the Northwest Republic are probably going to be pretty isolated in the first few years after independence, although in view of the chaos that will be going on in the rest of the world, that may well be a good thing. If you mean, do I plan to have everybody marching around in what looks like cheerleader outfits on football fields with huge pictures of me everywhere? No, in point of fact, while we're on that subject, let me quickly state something for posterity here. For various reasons I won't get into here, I most likely won't be around myself to see the day of victory, but if I am, and I do end up being fearless leader in the new republic, one of my first orders will be no pictures or statues of myself, or of anyone still living. After I'm dead, fine, you guys can make an HAC cult if you like, although frankly it would be a pretty damn boring cult. But one of our rules needs to be nobody gets elevated into the pantheon of heroes of the revolution, so to speak, until he's safely dead and we know for sure he can't screw up, and we can make sure that he doesn't have any weird skeletons that can come dancing out of his closet. And that includes me. I sure as hell hope to God that in my final years I won't go gaga like certain other deceased fearless leaders did, start engaging in weird photography habits or other eccentricities, but you never know. Although I can think of a couple of our present dead hero figures in the movement who ain't going in any pantheon I ever have charge of, because they do have some damn nasty skeletons in their closet, even if we choose to ignore them. We really don't want to be erecting statues or naming streets in the Republic after some of these old farts. Sorry, I'm wandering again. I really shouldn't ad-lib these things. As to trade, most likely during the first few years, or maybe the first few decades of the Republic, we'll be locked down by the kind of vicious economic sanctions that democracy loves to impose on countries and governments they don't like. I lived with those in Rhodesia, and I can tell you that they are annoying, but no more. We always managed to get hold of anything imported we really needed, and we also managed to manufacture what we couldn't import. This is one reason I've always insisted that the homeland has to be large enough to contain all the necessary resources for food and energy and self-defense. And above all, we must have a coastline with deep water ports for the time when the sanctions are lifted and we can begin trading with the world, or rather with what's left of the white world. Question number 6. The most pressing issue is how and when do you plan on establishing this new nation, and how can you ask people to simply move and wait? You speak of bold actions. Why not simply gain your numbers and declare the nation? A white nation will have to fight for itself one way or the other. A white nation will not be allowed to exist. You know this from Rhodesia. You haven't read the Northwest novels, have you, Larry? Look, folks, I'd like to ask something of all of you, and that is that if you have not actually read the four Northwest Independence novels, that you do so before you send in your questions and comments to this program or email me or whatever. This isn't because I'm an author fishing for more readers or trying to sell you books. The Northwest novels are available for free to anyone who wants them. They can be downloaded from http://wn-pdfs.tk if you don't mind reading a long book on a computer screen, or you can download them and print them out if you like so that you can read a hard copy. I'm asking this of you because those books contain information that explains everything, or almost everything, and answers your questions before they're asked. It is really very difficult for me to discuss these things with people who haven't read the novels. We need to be on the same page, if you'll pardon the pun. Question number 7. Will the new nation have a race code along with the lines of the Nuremberg laws? What about whites with salt and pepper in the bloodline? What if a white brings his non-Aryan spouse? No, this is not me. This makes me ill. Our bloodlines are being bred out. Check the Northwest Constitution, Larry. It's all at www.northwestfront.org. Folks, I understand that I'm going to be dealing with the same objections over and over and over again from now right on up until the day that tricolor flag first goes up at Longview or wherever it goes up. Right up until the day when we win the Northwest Republic and regain our freedom, there will be white men who are raising fatuous objections, giving me quibbles, giving me yes buts, giving me but what ifs, demanding that I produce a crystal ball and tell them exactly how everything will go guaranteed. A lot of you have been asking me about the arrests that took place in Michigan and Indiana and Idaho a week ago Sunday. The media have confirmed that there was a federal informant involved, and that pretty much means that the whole silly conspiracy was non-existent. The informer made it all up and instigated the whole thing, so what else is new? These arrests fit in very nicely with the central message. Anyone who opposes Obama is a violent nutcase who's planning on murdering police officers. Not anyone who actually means anything to the system, of course, and they must therefore be put in prison. As an aside, that's usually the first indication of the presence of a federal informant when these things hit the media. When the charge that the regime brings against someone is that far-fetched and outlandish, and when the alleged criminal activity is directed against some minor or sympathetic or ridiculous-sounding target, not directed against a big-name senator or anyone who actually holds any power, or any target that might actually affect the regime, then that's usually an indication that the case is fabricated from the get-go. Anyway, this Michigan thing is one of those cases where I'm expected to comment on the obvious, but all too many of our people don't seem to be able to grasp the obvious, so it appears necessary. Now, this is one lesson that we seem absolutely incapable of learning. We have been failing this exam for decades, and the story never seems to change. I can tell you exactly what happened because I have seen this same scenario so many times down through the years. We seem completely incapable of learning. Really, guys, this same story has been played out so many times it's not even approaching funny. And we still don't seem to have learned a goddamn thing. Our little white movement here isn't very good at most things, but we do have one great talent at which we excel. We are absolute aces at demonstrating how not to do it. Negative lessons can be a benefit, of course, if we can learn from them. But learning from our constant mistakes is an ability we don't seem to be able to develop. Either this changes, or 100 years from now, every bipedal inhabitant of this North American continent will have skin the color of shit. This so-called militia had all the usual problems that white Americans have when they embark on this trail. Americans have no idea at all how to organize for revolution, how to motivate for revolution, or how to behave as revolutionaries in a genuine underground pre-revolutionary environment. It's not in our history. Revolution has been attempted only twice in this country's history, only once successfully. And on both of those prior occasions, the attempts were led from the top down by politicians and lawyers and professional men and businessmen, by educated men of property and status. America has never experienced any attempt at revolution by any race or class of people who are genuinely on the bottom, as white Americans are today. And we don't have the slightest idea of how to go about it. Now, this isn't to say that a genuine bottom-up revolution can't be accomplished. Of course it can. It's been accomplished repeatedly over the past century, but we just haven't got a clue how to do it. And we think we're organizing a Rotary Club. Now, the first problem these people had was complete carelessness. Their website is still up on the internet, and there I see pictures of people in camouflage uniforms out in the woods somewhere, displaying and brandishing weapons. Why? Why did these people do that? Why would anyone do that if they were serious, warning the enemy of their presence? Do we not understand that such behavior is not only childish and bloody stupid, it is potentially lethal? What the hell is wrong with these people? And before anyone refers to my Northwest novels or Colonel House's Brigade and other books and videos that the Northwest Front puts out, my novels are fiction. My characters are fiction. They are not real people posing on real websites with real guns and subject to real arrest and real prison from real secret policemen. The FBI cannot arrest Zach Hatfield or Kiki McGee or Cody Brock. Now, these videos of the colonels contain IRA film clips and photoshopped cuts from the Northern Ireland Troubles, as are most of the images I use on my blogs when I'm posting excerpts from the Northwest novels and so forth. If the FBI doesn't like it, they can go run around South Armagh and try to arrest One-Shot Paddy. Lots of luck to them. The British Special Branch and the SES were never able to catch him. If we did have some kind of secret army running around in the woods conspiring to free the Northwest, why in God's name would I advertise the fact on the internet or anywhere else? One of the most bloody, stupid things Glenn Miller ever did was invite the media onto his farm to watch all his guys in camouflage blasting away with their guns, which resulted in all these anti-paramilitary training statutes courtesy of the ADL, and so now, technically speaking, the FBI has the legal grounds to come in and arrest a Boy Scout jamboree for so-called paramilitary training. And that's a law that can be used against any gun or hunting club if a U.S. attorney chooses to twist it around for that purpose. Tipping your hand like that is moronic. The FBI and the secret police must hold us in deep contempt for being such idiots. And you have to admit, we deserve it. These Huttery people went on the internet and showed off all their toys. They might as well have held out their wrists for the handcuffs and said, "Take me, I'm yours." How did the informer get inside the group? No details on that from the mainstream media, but again, I can give you an educated guess. It's just possible that the Bureau flipped one of the members in a straight cash transaction. The informer might be a woman whose child custody was threatened. I wrote about that kind of situation in the Brigade with Kiki McGee, and I wasn't making that up. That part of the plot was based on at least two real incidents that I've come across down through the years. I am proud to say that both of these women rejected these federal threats against their children with the contempt they deserved, and Pat actually went to prison herself rather than betray her husband. So for the record, yes, there are still a few good white women left. The informer might have been a member who was arrested for some other crime, either real or fabricated, and the feds held this over his head in order to coerce him to betray his friends and to betray common decency. But my guess is that the informer was someone who was introduced by another member over whom the feds had some kind of minor hold, maybe he was caught committing a minor crime, or otherwise they had established some kind of grip on the guy, and they compelled this compromised associate to show up at some meeting out around a campfire in Michigan or somebody's barn or garage with his arm around a stranger, and he said, "This is good old Joe. Good old Joe is a patriot through and through. I trust him and so can you," or words to that effect. Now, the reason I say this is that the American secret police don't like working with amateur informers, either bribed or coerced. They prefer to avoid that and work with tested professionals. There's too many problems with a forced or bribed informer's morale and motivation. There's too much pressure living a lie like that, and there's too much chance that the guy might crack or screw up or somehow give the game away. So once the informer gets in, then what? No doubt he starts to agitate and see what he can stir up by way of criminal conspiracy, but mostly he's a good listener rather than a talker. Remember, his goal is to get you and his other targeted victims on tape saying as much as possible while recording himself saying as little as possible, in case it should become obvious to even the most dim-witted jury of Joe the Plumbers that the informer is in fact the guy who's shepherding the conversation and instigating all the illegal talk. A lot of times, the videos and audio recordings will be creatively edited to remove certain provocative remarks by the informer. True, a real expert can tell when an audio recording has been altered, but how are these poor militia people going to afford the necessary experts with only a public defender in their corner? A public defender who's most likely been bought off by the state and who's probably the town drunk as well. But the main problem in these situations is what I call the Frank Braswell phenomenon, the obsessive armchair revolutionary. Usually he's a frustrated middle-aged man, but sometimes he's a damaged young skinhead or something of the kind who dreams of violence and revenge against everyone who's done him wrong and who simply will not shut up about it. He's the guy that the informer is after, the one the informer wants to get on tape, babbling away about making bombs and killing cops, and above all, the informer wants to get others on tape in the same room, either casually agreeing or else saying nothing. There have to be others present while the motor mouth is babbling away, because that's what makes the conspiracy element. I remember being told by one of the defense attorneys in the Asheville 6 case back in 1981, a guy who'd listened to the endless hours of phone taps and recorded conversations, and he said that all that would have been necessary at almost any time would have been for just one of the other five people involved to speak up and say out loud where the mic could hear them, "Frank, we're not going to do any of this stuff. Now shut the hell up about it." Just one person. But instead, they just let him ramble on and on and on about planting bombs in shopping centers because everybody knew him and they figured, oh, that's just Frank running his mouth like he always does. Now, I want to say again, don't get me wrong on this. There is nothing at all wrong with revenge, either in itself or as a motivation for participation in revolutionary politics. What is wrong is to sit around in somebody's living room or garage doing nothing but talking about it, while over in the corner sits a funny little man with a funny little tape recorder under his coat. Although now, of course, an informer doesn't even have to wear a wire. He or she can just do it all through a video cam cell phone. Imagine yourself sitting in prison serving some crushing sentence just for talking, or else for not speaking up and telling some idiot to keep his yap shut. Imagine listening to the niggers booga 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 all around you, wonder if the niggers have pissed in your food, all that kind of thing, day after day, night after night, year after year, and having to live with the knowledge that all you ever did to the people who have done this hideous thing to you was to talk. To know that you never fired a shot, never struck a blow, and you are suffering just as terribly as if you'd actually kill someone. The prosecutor and the judge and the informer who perjured himself, the federal agents and everybody else involved who did this terrible thing to you, are out barbecuing in the backyard or attending their daughter's high school graduation like you never will, or doing their Christmas shopping, or watching a DVD and drinking beer, while there you sit. And you never fired a single shot. I think for me that would be absolutely the worst thing of all about it. Guys, it's simple. I've said it before. I'll say it again, and I will keep on saying it. We have to change. We either learn to quit being Americans and start being bona fide revolutionaries, or that's where we're all headed. These people have no compunction at all about setting us up. There is no justice in this land, and that is why we have to fight and win, because our turn is coming, all of us. How do I surround this next part of the podcast with sufficient fig leaves and disclaimers? How do I protect myself from being dragged off in the middle of the night and extraordinarily rendered to a special CIA facility in Dracula's castle in Romania, where I can be tortured simply because I speak of things that the United States government doesn't want spoken about? Nuts. Now, bearing in mind the fate of the hapless militia members we were just discussing, I'm going to tell you some things about guerrilla warfare. Purely theoretical, of course. Heaven forbid anyone should take my comments here as some kind of incitement to break the divinely inspired laws of our beloved lords and masters, etc., etc., blah, blah, blah. Ishka Bibble, let's take all the usual disclaimers as read, okay? And my qualifications to speak on this subject are that I have served in two armies and two wars, and I have lived in three countries, Rhodesia, South Africa, and Ireland, which were undergoing guerrilla insurgency. Plus, I have studied history and politics and revolutionary movements as a lifelong vocation, in the hope that someday my own people might actually prove themselves capable of learning a few things. Acting on the highly tenuous proposition that anyone listening to this is serious, if muddled in their intentions, and they're not simply acting out middle-aged Rambo fantasies, I'm going to give you folks a few, well, not pointers, but let's say broad and general observations on how not to wage an insurrection against a certain powerful and entrenched tyranny which shall remain nameless. What I'm going to try and convey here is the fact that it is possible for you to prepare yourself about 95% to conduct an insurrectionary campaign of armed resistance against a tyrant and a tyrant's gun thugs without actually breaking any of the tyrant's laws up until the point where the first shot is actually fired. I'm going to explain to you how to do that. Okay, guys, here we go. Guerrilla Warfare 101. First and foremost, revolutionary movements, real ones, not guys running around in the woods waving their guns in the air and playing games, actual, real-world revolutionary movements act. They do not talk. I am presently fighting my own fight with words. I do not pretend otherwise. Why? Because right now, we are completely incapable of mounting the kind of armed insurrection that could win the Northwest Republic by force. That is the only moral and practical question that matters. Can we win? Right now, no, we can't. Ergo, no armed insurrection, no lawbreaking. Now, if I felt that armed revolt right here, right now was appropriate for the time and place, and for me personally, and if I felt it was the best way to achieve such a consummation devoutly to be wished, then I wouldn't be talking to you here and now. I would be shooting. I would not be talking about how I was going to start shooting just any old time now when the spirit moved me. Neither will I be sending people threats by email, or sending talcum powder to people in envelopes, nor will I be leaving threatening messages on their answering machines and getting myself a lengthy prison sentence for some symbolic gesture that most people in this country are too far rotted away in their own crapulence to understand or care about. That is the act of an idiot. Threatening someone at all is the act of an idiot. If you genuinely mean to carry out your threat, then you're simply putting your target on his guard. And if you don't mean to carry out your threat, then you're a coward and a disgrace to the cause that you purport to serve, who makes us all look ridiculous. A large part of the lack of respect that our point of view commands in this country is due to the fact that so many of our people are pompous blowhards and posers who dress up in camouflage fatigues and wave their semi-autos in the air for the television cameras while they brag and threaten their way right into a prison cell, babbling about all the valiant deeds they're going to do at some unspecified time down the pike. Please, 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 people, don't make fools of yourself and fools of the rest of us by doing this. Just stop it. You don't mean it, and we all know that you don't mean it. Now, there's an old saying, don't talk the talk if you're not going to walk the walk. I disagree. Don't talk the talk at all, under any circumstances. Either do it and keep your mouth shut, both before and after, or just plain keep your mouth shut. Secondly, do not stockpile weapons. Do not stockpile explosives. Do not stockpile anything at all except for food and batteries and medical supplies and that kind of thing if you're a survivalist type. Stockpiles of weapons and ammunition and explosives are nothing but nice, juicy propaganda plums for the organs of state security to seize and display for the media to show how big and bad and tough they are and do their Jack Bauer imitations for the cameras. If you have a stockpile, given the poor moral character of most white people, some pale-skinned scumbag will eventually panic and rat you out to save his own wretched hide. You will lose your stockpile and your freedom. There will be no other result from stockpiling, because the fact that someone stockpiles indicates that they're not serious. In an actual guerrilla war, which I repeat, I have seen, weapons are to be found in the hands of revolutionaries who use them, not sitting in a barn or buried under somebody's floorboards where they simply rust away and do not affect one iota of change. Guns are not toys. They are not phallic symbols. They are not substitutes for character and courage. A gun is a tool, just like a wrench or a hammer or a carpenter's level. A gun is a tool that the revolutionary uses to create change. And like all tools, it belongs in the craftsman's hands. No carpenter ever built a house by assembling 500 saws and hammers and half a ton of nails and then burying them all out in the woods. During the time I was in Ireland, out of possibly 2,000 active supporters, as opposed to drunken pub sympathizers who sing the old songs at closing time, the provost never had more than about 50 people on active service at any given time in the north, and maybe a dozen or so on mainland Britain and in Europe, usually bombing units. Their ratios of talkers to doers are almost as bad as ours, although at least they do have a few real fighters. The IRA has always had far more guns than they have men who are willing to pull the trigger. Now, in the 1980s, judging from such public information as I had access to, my estimate would be that as far as firearms went, the IRA actually fired maybe 100 rounds per year of all calibers in actual combat, and that includes assassinations and kneecappings. One average right-wing gun nut in America pisses away more ammo than that on a Saturday afternoon exterminating beer cans out in the woods somewhere. And yet those 50 men and 100 or so rounds per year, along with their explosives, tied down something like 50,000 British troops, police, and auxiliary for almost 30 years. And if the provost technically didn't win, neither did they lose. They eventually forced a major Western democracy to pay them off. It can be done, guys. Speaking of explosives, don't. No disclaimers on this one, people. Leave explosives alone unless you really, and I mean really, know what the hell you're doing with them. The first explosives to start modern guerrilla fighters off with are Molotov cocktails and hand grenades, which are illegal to have, and so you shouldn't even have them until the line has been breached and the FBI is coming after you anyway for posting a poem on the internet or whatever. So then it's in for a penny, in for a pound. Anyone can find all kinds of cocktail recipes for homemade napalm and so forth all over the internet. Hungarian teenagers did wonders with them against Soviet tanks in Budapest in 1956. Now, Oklahoma City notwithstanding, I highly recommend that whenever possible, a guerrilla group who decides that they want to make things go boom in the night should acquire proper commercial stuff like Semtex and dynamite, and not screw around with homemade stuff some science nerd whips up in his basement. Yeah, I know what I said in my novels. That's fiction. In real life, the IRA in the 1980s went through a period where they were diddling around with bathtub gel ignite and they had all kinds of work accidents and blew themselves up all over the place. They switched to Semtex and used it to bring London almost to a standstill in the early 1990s and thus won their Good Friday payoff. You might also remember those three idiot weathermen who blew themselves up in that townhouse in Greenwich Village in 1970. You do not need automatic weapons. Do not buy them. Do not stockpile them. Expel from your group immediately anyone who offers to procure them for you. He is a cop. Unless you are properly trained in their use, machine guns are more dangerous to you than they are to the enemy. Machine guns are not toys with which to play John Wayne on the sands of Iwo Jima. I once saw a stupid nigger at Fort Jackson come very short because he'd watched too many movies and he thought his M60 was a toy. Automatic weapons have two specific uses in military tactics. One is for the defense of established positions. The other is as part of a highly trained and properly led fire team for use in fire and maneuver assaults. If and when the balloon finally does go up, in any realistic scenario that may actually occur in real life, you are not going to be engaging in Rambo-like shootouts with police and SWAT teams and troops. At least not more than once, you won't. You do not have that kind of skill and training level. No, you don't. A guerrilla movement can accomplish anything they need to accomplish to attain the initial objectives of an insurrection with other tactics and other weapons. The trick is to learn how to fight high-tech with low-tech. Look at the Iraqis. A large part of guerrilla tactics consists of striking at the enemy's soft targets while avoiding direct confrontation with superior forces, not seeking it out. In the real world, the initial stages of any kind of guerrilla insurgency in the United States, on the part of us or anyone else, will be more like mob hits or gangbanger shootings than traditional partisan guerrilla groups with bandoliers and berets, and most of the action will almost certainly be in cities and towns rather than in the open countryside. That's my opinion based on the present American context, anyway. And yes, I could be wrong. It all depends on how and when and under what circumstances the balloon really does go up, which we don't know yet. But right now, this is just me calling it as I see it coming. Like I said, materially speaking, you can get yourself 95% ready to throw down with the tyrant and his hirelings without breaking a single law. The main precaution is simple. Do not allow any Tom, Dick, and Harry to walk into your living room or your garage without some kind of background check. The majority of the preparation that a guerrilla fighter must perform is within himself. Let me describe to you, in a brief summation, what guerrilla life is like. On the subject of tactics, the motto of any guerrilla group must be never defend, always attack. Never allow the enemy to bring his superior force to bear. By the nature of things, a guerrilla group will be facing forces which are vastly superior in numbers, in equipment, in training, in resources, and in organization. The psychological pressure alone of living like this would send most white Americans stark raving bonkers in a week. The guerrillas will always be outgunned on an overall level, so the trick is to make sure that at the point of contact, the insurgents always outgun the occupiers in that one small kill zone. You will have to move in, terminate the targets, and move out. Fast, fast, fast. Attack. Hit, 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 and move, move, move. Never go to ground. Never hole up, or if you must, never for long in one place. Always change hideouts every 24 hours max. Escape and evade. Never lose the initiative. Make the enemy's head spin. He should never know where you are or what you're doing or where you will strike next. He should be stumbling after you, picking up bodies, until suddenly you turn around, lay an ambush, and hit him. Now, I'm sure all of this sounds very romantic, and so it would be for about a week, and then most of you would get bored with it, or more likely terrified as you came to your senses, and you would want to go home and turn on the TV and forget about the whole thing. But the problem is you can't. Once the line is crossed, once they're coming after you to send you into living hell, whether it's for killing an FBI agent or posting a poem on the internet, you either fight on until you win or until you die, most likely that last. Now, how many of these big, bold militia types who put their pictures on the internet wearing Sears Roebuck hunting camis and waving a semi-auto in the air can live like that? How many middle-class white Americans can really do that, live like that for months and years on end? Come on, people. I mean, really. The Order and the Symbionese Liberation Army lasted, what, 4 months, 6 months each, something like that? I'm not saying it can't be done. It can be. I am saying that you can't do it. Not until you undergo a spiritual transformation and become the same man that your great-grandfather was back in the day. Until you can grow stronger, not just in body but in mind and in soul. Strong enough to live outside the herd in the lonesome forest all on your own. Strong enough to do what has to be done and then not worry about it ever. Strong enough to accept the imminence of death and not worry about it ever. Strong enough to take on yourself the burden of changing the world and to renounce everything that is material and selfish and weakening. Until you can do all that, then stop wasting everyone's time with your silly little pictures in camouflage suits on the internet. You will find yourself doing the time without having done the crime. You will find yourself doing a revolutionary's prison sentence without being a real revolutionary, without ever having struck a blow at the people who will torture you every day for all those years and then go home to their sofas and their plasma TVs at night and laugh at you. Put your guns away until you are ready to stop waving them in the air for a webcam and start pointing them at the men and the women who do such terrible evil in this land. Either do it and keep your mouth shut, or just keep your mouth shut, period. The basic strategy of American militia and survivalist groups, insofar as they have any, which isn't very far, is based on static defense of their communities. Now, against urban nigger gangbangers in a civil disorder situation, or Mad Max-style outlaws in a time of total social breakdown, that may be a feasible goal. Against the government and its enforcers, this strategy is absurd and suicidal. Again, this assumes with a big suspension of disbelief that the present militias would resist at all instead of throwing down their guns and blubbering to the DA for a plea bargain. Never, never, never allow yourself to be pinned down in a compound of any kind. You will be facing the most overwhelming concentration of military and police power in human history. Ask Randy Weaver how that worked out for him. Ask the Branch Davidians. Ask the Montana Freedmen. Ask Ed and Lorraine Brown how well the federal government respected their title deed to their home. To be surrounded is the end. Period. Now, having told you in a general way how to do it, don't. This isn't just a disclaimer. A guerrilla movement that just starts shooting without a political and spiritual base among the people they're supposed to be liberating won't last 6 months. Ask the order men how that worked out for them. A resistance movement that does not take the time to lay a propaganda and political base won't win, and a lot have failed on those very grounds. We have completely wasted the past 50 years, and we now have a very short time left in which to create the kind of infrastructure and the kind of base that we should have begun working on 50 years ago after Little Rock. That is a fact. Some of this wastage was due to sincere and hopeful expeditions down some dead ends, which, in retrospect, were pretty obvious. The Duck Club and electoral politics are two examples that spring to mind. Now, we have also been plagued with a series of self-appointed leaders who have been corrupt, incompetent, and dishonest, and we're still plagued with some of these holdovers from the past. You can yell and scream and moan and spread rumors and I'm a government agent all you want, but that's a fact as well. Had we not wasted those 50 years, it is possible that we might be in a position now to engage in actual resistance against the regime. We are not. And anyone who tells you otherwise is either a damned fool or a cop of some kind. I am telling you to get your heads together and learn. I am not asking you to die for your race. I am asking you to live for it. And more difficult, I'm asking you to work for it. I know this is a message many don't want to hear. For the sake of our future, folks, you'd best take heed. One of the hoariest and most time-honored of the movement's sacramental beasts is the concept of when the balloon goes up. I know I think I've gone over this in the past, but I tell you again, there's going to be a lot of repetition on here because there are certain ideas that have to sink through. Now, the concept runs something like this. The white man is completely lazy, apathetic, cowardly, dazed and confused and useless. I have to admit, it's kind of hard to argue with that one. He will continue to be so long as he has his job, his paycheck, his beer in the refrigerator, his television, and the Quickie Mart down the street run by Apu, where he can stock up on salty snacks for his long weekends watching niggers bounce a ball. The white man will never, ever get up off his ass until such time as the supply of all these things is suddenly cut off by some huge catastrophe, an economic collapse with a massive depression, race riots in the streets, fuel shortages, beer shortages, aliens descending from outer space, or whatever your favorite scenario might be. Now, this huge catastrophe will supposedly create a Mad Max Road Warrior type scenario, and all of a sudden we'll be riding around on motorcycles with green mohawk haircuts and driving out in the muds with crossbows, yada, yada, yada. I've never understood how a race of people who have spent their entire lives on the couch watching niggers play basketball and swilling beer will suddenly transform into road warriors, but we'll let that pass. Right-wingers generally refer to this scenario as when the balloon goes up. Now, the sickening corollary to all this is that since, supposedly, nothing can possibly be done while Zog remains all-seeing, all-knowing, and all-powerful, which it isn't, anyway, supposedly there's no point whatsoever in our actually doing anything until such time as the balloon goes up, or even trying. The people in the Times are just not ready for us. If only the people in the Times were ready. Oh my, such deeds of manly heroism we would do then. But the balloon hasn't gone up yet, and things aren't bad enough yet, and so therefore all we can do is just educate people and wake people up. And if an inquiring mind is ever able to cut through the mountains of waffle and get any kind of answer on this subject, education usually boils down to nothing more than hiding behind an email address while playing with a computer in one's basement rec room with a bowl of nachos and a cold brewski beside the mouse. Education in practice means circulating the same old material, mostly dating from the 1950s and 1960s, or even from before the war. The same old stuff that we've been circulating since the Eisenhower administration about Jews running the Federal Reserve, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were Jews, the Benjamin Franklin quotation, so forth and so on, and, of course, an endless supply of atrocity stories about black crime. And, of course, there is that lovely, risk-free internet. The movement of yesteryear consisted largely of a bunch of sad old men who sat around mailing each other news clippings, telling one another how bad things are. And some of them are still around today. Today, it consists mostly of a bunch of sad old men who sit around tapping on keyboards and forwarding news articles all over the internet by email and posting them to VNN and Stormfront and so on, telling one another how bad things are. Oh, look what they're doing to us now. Isn't it all so horrible what they're doing now? Blah, 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 blah. But what can we do? The white man is useless until the balloon goes up, right? Now, let me dare to ask the blasphemous question. Is the balloon ever going to go up? I mean, really? Now, we've been waiting for almost 50 years now for this big disaster to occur that will finally shake the federal monkey off our backs long enough so we can take all those guns out of the closet and clean this mess up. But let's think about this. Has anything of the kind ever even come close to occurring? No. The riots of the 1960s and the 1990s were purely localized events and consisted almost entirely of niggers trashing their own neighborhoods. There was never any serious danger to the system, and all of these events were brought under control by the authorities in a matter of days. The fuel shortages of the 1970s were annoying, but nothing more. The Democrats' incompetence looks to produce gas prices as high as $4 per gallon this summer. White Americans are going to grumble and groan and call Rush Limbaugh and bitch about it, and then they will pay. We can't have the kids missing Six Flags over Memorial Day, now can we? Will there ever, in fact, be some kind of nationwide catastrophe which will crack the iron bands that crush us and remove the federal government's heavy hand from us all at once, so all of a sudden we find that we can do the necessary? Now, this, of course, presumes that we have the required physical courage and the will to do the necessary under any circumstances at all, and that's pretty dubious, but well, we won't get into that. Will there ever be a depression so severe, a riot so widespread, an event so cataclysmic that it will, in fact, affect the supply of basic goods and services in most areas of the United States to any serious or lasting extent? Is that really going to happen? Will the electric power ever really go off and stay off, silencing the air conditioners and the computers and the plasma TVs? Yes, it can happen. It certainly happened to the people of Iraq, but will it happen here, ever? Or will our future be just one long, endless, slow decline, a gradual deterioration of the quality of life, year after year, as more and more of North America turns into Brazil? I'll be honest, I still don't know. Now, granted, we seem to be getting a lot closer than we ever have been. 20% real unemployment is no joke. Millions of Americans facing foreclosure or already homeless is no joke. The collapse of the insurance and banking industries is no joke, I will grant you. It's never been quite this bad before, but the FBI and the military are still getting their paychecks and packing those guns on their hips to do the will of Obama and the Democrats and the Jews behind them, notably George Soros. The Walmarts are still full of cheap Chinese junk and customers to buy it, even if most of those customers are Mexican. Gas is getting higher, but there are no lines at the pump yet, and above all, there's still gas available. The power is still on, and while there will probably be ever more rolling blackouts and brownouts this summer as the air conditioners surge, looks like it's going to stay on. One thing I've learned in the movement is that making predictions is a dangerous business, but I do believe that if, in fact, the balloon were anywhere near going up, there would be certain definite indicators, and they would be visible and discussed outside the babblings of right-wing conspiracy theorists on the internet. Now, as admittedly bad as things are getting, there doesn't appear to be any sign that anything of the kind is happening. This is a huge country, and it still possesses virtually unlimited wealth. As god-awful as things are, America's ability to absorb economic, political, social, and biological punishment and abuse is still a long, long way from reaching the breaking point. And you know something? I think all of us know in our heart that the balloon ain't going up anytime soon. And hoo boy, are we glad. You see, that balloon lets us off the hook. You remember Leaderless Resistance, the brilliant strategy laid out by Louis Beam? And you remember how and why it failed? Because in actual practice, it turned out to be all leaderless and no resistance. Beam's plan was predicated on the idea that these leaderless resistance cells would actually do something. It never happened. The internet came along and everybody retreated into the cool dark of their basement rec room and the warm glow of their computer screen. Do you remember Lone Wolf, the strategy William Pierce tried to inspire with Hunter? It ended up being all lone and no wolf, or in a few cases, it ended up being lone nut. What we ended up with, instead of hunters, were violent kooks like Ben Smith and Buford Furrow, who were, of course, cheered on hysterically by certain people in order to sell their skinhead music tapes and videos, as if the white race could be saved by lunatics who hear voices in their heads. Now, am I alone in suspecting that a lot of this talk about when the balloon goes up is just basically an excuse for the white man to continue to do nothing? Maybe I'm off base, but as Northwest migration begins to catch on, slowly, way too slowly, I'm starting to hear a lot of this, but we must wait for the balloon to go up, and it's sounding increasingly worried. Here we now have a perfectly legal, perfectly logical, and personally beneficial act that anyone can carry out, and which will advance the cause of the 14 words and give white people a wonderful place to live. Bluffs are being called here in the Northwest, and the movement is getting jumpy. There is one thing that movement man definitely does not like, and that's having his bluff called. Okay, let's recap once again. We need to take another look at that revolutionary tripod, the three conditions which are essential for actual political and social change to take place in any society. I know, I've gone over this about 500 times before, but guys, this is really important. This is really something we all need to internalize. For there to be revolutionary change, the following three conditions must obtain. Number one, the withdrawal of the consent of the governed. A majority, or at least a significant and effective minority, of the people of a nation or a colony must consciously desire an end to the existing political and social order and its replacement by a new one. It certainly helps if they want your revolutionary movement specifically to replace the existing order, although, as Lenin and the Bolsheviks proved, it's not absolutely necessary. A fighting revolutionary party is the second requirement. A political, propaganda, and military vehicle must exist that will express the people's withdrawal of consent in concrete terms, and which is prepared to replace the existing order and which is ready and willing to take direct action to do so. We're working on that, the Northwest Front. The third requirement is the loss of the credible monopoly of armed force. All political power is based on the use of deadly force by the ruler or the state, the infliction or threat of bodily harm or death on others, without the punishment of those who exercise force in the state's name. This is what makes the policeman's club or gun different from the club or the gun in the hands of the criminal. The policeman may do harm without being punished for it, except within certain narrow parameters when he harms an influential or politically protected person through error, stupidity, whatever. And sometimes even then, he's never punished at all. This is called a credible monopoly of armed force, the ability of the state to do harm without consequences. In order for any revolutionary movement to succeed, it must first break that credible monopoly of armed force by demonstrating to the public an ability to do harm to its enemies and not be punished. Classic example here, the Irish Republican Army. The people must be made to understand that change is, in fact, possible, because the state is no longer certain to be able to punish those who oppose it. Eventually, the revolutionary movement transfers the monopoly of armed force to itself, thereby becoming the established state, and that's how revolutions occur. Now, let's back up a bit to the withdrawal of the consent of the governed and the creation of a viable revolutionary party. How exactly is this to be achieved? Well, first, there has to be one or more legitimate grievances. Those we have in plenty. Our ancestors in 1775 revolted over a paltry tax on tea. Our closer forefathers in 1861 revolted over a massive insult to the South and the Southern way of life on the part of the rest of the United States, as expressed in the election of the demagogue Abraham Lincoln to the presidency. Today, we don't bat an eyelid when a nigger is elected to the presidency. Today, we let our own children be routinely murdered, sodomized, drugged, corrupted in their minds and bodies, and frog-marched into mediocrity while we sit there staring at the television. But let's assume that somehow we can, in fact, overcome the character problem, and a significant minority of us do have sense enough to migrate to the Northwest and eventually form a fighting revolutionary party, specifically the Northwest Front. Let's just suppose. Right. We have our party. What do we do? How would we go about bringing on a revolution if, as it appears, the pesky balloon just ain't going to go up anytime soon? I know the idea of actually doing things scares many of you shitless. We need to start cultivating the habit of in-depth thinking insofar as we're still capable of it. And thought must be free. Thought must have all the data in order to draw conclusions. Thought cannot be Orwellian and deliberately train itself to avoid certain topics, or else the mind ceases to hit on all cylinders. Maybe if you can be brought to understand the possibilities which would become available to us, and if and when we ever deal with a character issue, then we might be able to persuade ourselves to actually deal with it.
Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front, P.O. Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington, 98310. You can visit the party on our website at www.northwestfront.org. Until next week, comrades. Hail Victory.
Oh, what glorious pride of sorrow filled the name of 98. Yet, thank God, it still is beating heart in manhood's morning new. Who could follow in their footsteps at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon?